revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a special show and a special guest. We're going to speak with Ms. Shannon Rowan, and she's a Wi-Fi refugee, a fine artist, a photographer, geopolitical and health author, researcher, and an EMF awareness educator. Her new book, The Red Shoes, is one of the topics that we're going to discuss today because I think from a healthcare perspective, we've been inundated with AI and this feeling that it's better than human, better than doctors, smarter and infallible. And I've seen a change from when I was in training and obviously when we were in school, where we had to learn, we had to have critical thinking, we didn't depend on a computer. And I worry now about our society, specifically doctors coming out now, who won't be able to think on their own, who have to run everything through a program in order to treat patients. And we always see the good side, but we don't really see the bad side of this. So Ms. Rowan, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, because I think you're going to give us a more encompassing overview of what AI and technology and our dependence on computers really mean.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me on, Dr. George. I'm really looking forward to this.
Me too. So let me ask first, is there, because most people just go along, they have their computers, their laptops and this, is there something that made you look deeper and actually critically think now about whether this is an awesome thing that we're all experiencing?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, and it will explain the first part of the bio you read, which is what I mean by a Wi-Fi refugee. Kind of like it sounds, I actually have had to move several times over the last, it's been almost about 13 years, roughly, since I was what I call injured by our technology, by these exposures to microwave frequencies. And that happened when I was living in Washington, D.C., which is basically where I'm from. And I've traveled a lot, lived around the world, a lot of places. I was a photojournalist for a while, so I did a lot of traveling. And, I did read about possible environmental impacts and health impacts when the first phones were coming out in the 90s, because I just read environmental magazines. I was interested in that. So I was like, huh. So I knew a little bit that it wasn't maybe good, but I didn't know how bad it could be or how it would end up affecting me personally. So I was always a cautious user. I mean, I did end up with a cell phone because of my work, but I, you know, turned it off at night, kept it out of the bedroom, kind of kept it away from my head as much as I could. And I did notice like heating effects in my head when I was using it, like for a long time. And I would limit the calls because it was uncomfortable, but I didn't really worry about it too much. I thought, well, you shouldn't live right next to a cell tower, but, you know, 50 feet away is cool or whatever. And I just didn't know. I didn't even know that where I was living, once I got affected, I realized, I looked at the maps, coverage maps, and there were, within like a mile radius, there were like 600 antenna and like 100 towers that popped up, you know, in that time period. And so I got harmed when the 4G rolled out. I know people who got, you know, felt it when the 3G rolled out, and also smart meters had gone in my home at the same time. And I got a smartphone, and all that kind of escalated into me having this tipping point of exposure, is how I see it, where it pushed me into like hypersensitivity and reactivity, the way you would with a food allergy or something, where you too many exposures, suddenly you have allergic reactions. So for me, I still feel immediately the effects of holding a cell phone, being near it, being near Wi-Fi, which is meant just, it's so intolerable, the physical effects, that I just couldn't live in a city anymore. And I couldn't even live in a suburb, because then I found that just this had cropped up everywhere. And now it's even hard. We're very remote now, and it's just encroaching more and more. So I became an advocate for, you know, educating, and I have a background in writing and journalism. So I ended up writing books. My first book is called Wi-Fi Refugee, Plight of the Modern Day Canary. So I see us as canaries in the coal mine, you know, here to warn people like that this is affecting all biology. There's never been proven to be helpful to biology. And there's plenty of evidence to show it's harmful. In fact, there's just tens of thousands of papers. You can access them online at emfportal.org. And that's one place you can just find it all. You know, that resource is great. I always tell people about that if they're skeptical, because this is studies conducted by our own military, by, you know, a lot of different fields in science. And they've known for a long time that there are biological effects. So that's what prompted me into get really deep diving into this subject.
Well, it's interesting. I can give you a clinical corollary to that, because I've seen several patients now who have jobs that make them use headsets and, you know, wireless headsets for hours, whether they're part of the air traffic controllers or they're doing telecommunications or operators, and they've had to stop using it because every time they put it on, they have horrible headaches, ringing in the ear, brain fog. And I think initially there was nothing they could do about it, but now that we've had, and I've actually had to write letters in their defense, I think it's becoming more common, and now they're able to get disability because of it. But there doesn't seem to be any, at least from a work perspective, mindset of you have OSHA talk about sound, you know, noise exposure, but nothing in terms of EMF. And hopefully that's going to come online, because there's a lot of injured people who don't even know why it's happening. And the younger set, I mean, from a societal standpoint, they live their lives on these phones. I mean, we didn't have them. We may have used them when they first came out minimally. We actually went to see each other, right? We were cordial and communal. It's like everybody's sitting around a table texting each other. It's a completely different ballgame, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And that's what led me into, I mean, of course, I started with coming at this from the perspective of physical harm and educating people about that. But I found like people very resistant to hearing this message. And I thought, well, why is that? And then I saw the addiction. And the addiction is driving this denial. People do not want to ever hear that the thing they're addicted to is bad for them. And they'll do everything they can to block that message. And so you just, you know, and the design of the technology is meant to be addictive. You know, it's meant for maximizing user engagement is the terminology they use. And it's like, we're the users. So we're like the drug users, and they want to maximize that engagement because that's how they make the most money. And to do that, they make the products addictive. And they are very addictive. And this is why we see this now socially acceptable, very antisocial behavior of people. You know, I mean, I think they call it fubbing now, like where you take your phone and you're like snubbing people by using it. But it's like so common that nobody really says anything. It's always very uncomfortable to me, not only because like somebody using their phone is like somebody smoking in front of me and blowing the smoke into my face and I'm feeling that, but as socially, I feel bad. I mean, we all do. It's like, we know we're feeling ignored and that somebody's giving preference to this other somebody or something on their screen over interacting with us. So we're all feeling that sense of isolation, even while we're sitting in the room together. And it's destructive socially.
Well, you see the rise of depression, anxiety, even though we're supposed to be, you know, from a world community, we're all engaging with each other, but you shouldn't see a rise in these types of mental distress if this was actually worth it, right? You see children harming themselves, self-harm, people, and on the flip side, being rude and obnoxious because they can get away with it because you think you're anonymous. But I want to go back to what you said about the addictive side of this. What is it? I mean, it reminds me of going to a casino and having all these lights flashing and pinging sounds, and you're overwhelmed in, you know, in terms of your filter of things coming at you. Is that what the phone is doing as well?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the design is actually a slot machine design. So yeah, literally. So it uses intermittent variable rewards, IVR, and that's the slot machine design. So what that means is the addiction heightens when the results are unpredictable, and that's what gambling addiction really stems from, right? You don't know what's going to come, what you're going to get. So when you have a prompt for somebody liking something you posted or a comment coming in, these are timed in a way to maximize your again, user engagement. So they don't come in real time anymore. because you don't know when it's going to happen, it makes it more enticing, right? So these rewards, these are all brain dopamine hit rewards. And they really are. It seems like a little thing, like, no, we can't be addicted to that. It's not really doing that much. But in terms of your brain and the pleasure center and the stimulus of that, this is sophisticated design. You know, these are people who've researched us a long time and studied us and our behaviors and what gives us these dopamine hits. And the reason the dopamine hits are a problem is that you're getting them without any efforting. So when you're just, you know, tapping a screen or something, it's the same as like mainlining heroin. I mean, it's going right into you. So a dopamine that you get from efforting, that with like, say you worked at something a long time and then you get that dopamine, that's fine and that's healthy because it's balanced with other chemicals that you would get. And you're using your body, you're moving in physical space. So when you're just sitting and you're just getting these things that are like stimulating you, and it is stimulating in the way you mentioned too, in terms of like actual like lights and sound and, you know, flashing. So this is another way to like stimulate you. And it is a stimulus addiction, and the EMFs themselves are stimulating. So people get addicted to just the electromagnetic fields that are coming off of these devices, because those also, they alter brainwaves. They can change your mood. We're all kind of going around really depleted, because when you're overstimulated all the time, the flip side of that is you're going to run out of energy easily. And you're going to have that repercussion of like, you know, having caffeine, then you have the crash, or any kind of stimulus drug, you have the crash. And so nobody wants the crash. So as the minute you start feeling that way, you reach for the stimulus again as the way to fix that, which is obviously like this downward spiral of self-destruction. And this is why people just can't, I see it all the time. Even when I'm trying to engage with them, I don't use a phone. I don't use these things. I don't have use this portable stuff. I'm not on social media anymore. I'm very careful about my internet use. And not only from the EMF perspective, but for these other reasons, because the whole internet itself is designed to be addictive. It's not just social media or games. It's everything. It's when you're searching things, it's like, you know, again, these pop-ups and the fact that you're even like getting information, like I'm addicted to information. I'll admit that. So like we all have our Achilles heel, you know, we all have our vulnerabilities and these are being exploited. So I'm not somebody who's saying I'm not addicted and I don't have a problem with this. I see it more clearly, and my research has helped me to see it. And if we see it, we'll have more power over it. I mean, if you don't see it at all and you're not willing to look at it, you can't make any changes for yourself. But for me as a researcher, of course, like it's getting the information that's the thing that I'm looking, you know, my reward. And the faster the connection is and the more easily we obtain that thing we're seeking, again, we're getting that dopamine hit without enough efforting. So I see how it affects me and my moods and my cognitive function and how I can focus or not afterward. Because it's one thing to have it happening when you're online, but it affects your offline life. So I'm out there after I've multitabbed and multitasks and, you know, got all my information and got all my dopamine hits. The real world is slowed down in a way that can be really painful sometime. It's hard to adjust to that rhythm, even though I know it's good for me. I can have a really hard time downshifting from that high speed and just doing the dishes. And like, this is where we're seeing people are not taking care of themselves adequately. They're letting all these things go, just like you would with any like drug addiction, where you're not taking care of yourself because those things feel too difficult to do. And so it's disabling us. The more we use the technology and the more we rely on it, you know, it's disabling us in so many ways. And this is what I get into in my last book, you know, The Red Shoes. So I'm sorry, I said a lot there. So feel free to.
No, actually, you're right on point. And I want to take our first break because I want to take another little bit of a detour to what you're saying. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Shannon Rowan. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of giving us this overview of how we're being manipulated and indoctrinated. And I want to talk now about the social side. You and I, at least, are of an age where we know what research is. how to do detective work, how to be discerning about what's, you know, who's underwriting, for example, medical journals, and should we actually believe what they, what their conclusions are? So we have this, I think, healthy skepticism. With this rise of technology, do you think they're trying to make us believe that whatever's in the internet is true? You know, what's the overview? Is that what's going on?
Oh, yeah. You know, and what I've noticed in recent years, especially, is the search engines like used to bring up more relevant, answers to what you put in that you're searching for. And it was less discriminatory about like what pops up first. But now I'm seeing that it's like a propaganda machine. And so all the first hits pages of it are like what the mainstream propaganda, you know, tech company investors want us to see as the answer. And it's not even relevant often to my question, my query. And that's another way it actually keeps us engaged longer too, is to give us a lot of irrelevant answers to sift through. So it's like wasting our time, which starts to really get me angry that I'm getting my time wasted. But I, not only that, I'm not even finding. So it, they don't have to, like, the way censorship is happening is they don't have to take down your website. They make it impossible to find. It's not going to come up in the search results. Even if you're like very specific about your search result and you're using all the methods of getting that, it's, they're making it harder and harder to find. And on top of that is the AI. This is what's really getting to me lately, is that everybody's now going to AI and asking the questions, thinking the AI is, you know, we've been programmed to believe that this is smarter than humans and it's going to outpace us and everything. And it's like, we can never keep up. Yet statistically, do you know that 60% of the AI answers are incorrect?
60%? That's huge.
60% are incorrect. And so I'm having people who I feel like should know better, other researchers who don't, aren't even really supportive of AI, you know, saying, well, I asked AI and it said this, and like assuming it's right. I'm like, well, AI is just pulling from the crap. And it's actually, you know, like, so like, you know, it yourself, if you put something in a search engine, to like disregard most of those answers, and you're at least looking at them and where they're coming from with this, you know, maybe hopefully a critical eye, and saying, okay, that's trash, that's trash, that's trash. But when AI is like getting all of it for you in a nice, tidy little bundle, and it sounds like it's saying, you know, presenting it in an intelligent way that makes sense, it's harder for you to say, well, that's right or wrong. You know, or that might be like, yeah, funded by who, whatever, like body I don't really trust. They have an agenda. And so they were just like accepting it because, oh, it's gathered it all. It sifted through it all really quickly and it made this decision. Well, it is a computing machine. It does not have human experience, will never have human experience, can never have human intelligence because it doesn't have human experience. It's not biological. It again, back to the human experience, it can't be like us or have our intelligence, which we're underestimating because as we're losing it and getting dumbed down, maybe we've forgotten how amazing it is, you know, but we have this ability to have compassion and empathy, and not just mimic those things and to like make deductions and, again, yeah, think critically if you've been taught to do that, but a machine doesn't do that. So it can mimic certain things, but it doesn't have those qualities. So it doesn't know, it doesn't have the ability to question, you know, these things. So it's like, it's really disappointing to me that I'm seeing so many people go and just say, AI said it, so it's right. And it isn't right. And I've already had some of these answers sent to me and I'm like, no, that's not right. So, you know, frightening direction we're going in, and so quickly, and for children, especially, who are turning to the machines for companionship, for friendship, you know, don't know, have anybody to talk to. Like there are a lot of studies, you know, they're saying that they're actually admitting that they'd rather talk to AI than a friend or a human because, you know, they're becoming so awkward socially. And it's hard, you know, as you don't practice something, of course, it's harder to do. And that includes socially interacting.
Well, imagine when you were a teenager, you know, preteen, when you have all these hormones raging, you basically feel so awkward that it's sad that you're not going to be able to work through this and actually gain skills that you're going to need as an adult. So this, it's like infantilizing people. How do they deal with something that doesn't go their way? Is this going to be violence? Is it going to be self-harm? What's going to happen, do you think, to the younger generation being able to be adults and work, you know, work through problems and be contributing members of society?
Well, I think that we have the answer already, and that some of these have already grown up and they're taking control and they're the ones pushing the AI on us. I mean, that's what they're into, you know, because they don't know how, they don't know what they are missing or destroyed or, you know. I mean, I've met them, you know, just interacting. I met somebody working in AI called a field called bio AI, you know, and I asked him, and he's much younger than me, you know, well, aren't you worried about this kind of taking over? And like, he's like, well, no, because, you know, it's just like kids growing up, they take over. And, you know, so AI is growing up, it's going to take over. No big deal. I thought, wow. Okay. Right. So disconnect there. But I mean, like you said earlier in the show, I think that this is statistically, it's being proved out in what we're seeing with the increase, like dramatic exponential increases in self-harm, suicide statistics, you know, in young people, if they even make it into adulthood, you know, they're very damaged because they, I mean, it's like, if this is so great for us and so great for society, then why aren't we seeing it improve anything, really? You know, is it improving our health, our mental health, our relationships, the important things? Is it even increasing our wealth? It's increasing wealth for some people, but there's more disparity in income than there was. There's more increased poverty. It's not, we're not getting the results that we've been promised. And I think, and unfortunately, like, the same mistake is being made again, where we turn to the same thing that caused the problem to begin with to try to fix it, like more tech. Let's throw more tech at it to fix the problems that tech created. That's not going to work. And I don't know. I think we're all also programmed to believe it will eventually work. And we just have to push through this awkward, terrible time where everybody, all these kids are killing themselves, because eventually it's going to be so great. And it isn't. I don't believe that. I think that that is really naive. And I think that is a totally false narrative, and it's pushed on us by people who don't have our best interests in mind, who only care about furthering their wealth and power positions and at our expense. So
I think you can take it one step forward. They don't like us. They don't like humanity. They think we're flawed. They think that they have the answer and they should rule it. Right? So I know better than you, and I need to control it. And to me, I think you hit the nail on the head, where it's creating a people who don't know what good is, who don't trust themselves, their own inner voice, because somehow the machine knows better and I should just follow along. But you're going to get a group of people who never push back, won't you?
Well, I think that we have the answer already, and that some of these have already grown up and they're taking control and they're the ones pushing the AI on us. I mean, that's what they're into, you know, because they don't know how, they don't know what they are missing or destroyed or, you know. I mean, I've met them, you know, just interacting. I met somebody working in AI called a field called bio AI, you know, and I asked him, and he's much younger than me, you know, well, aren't you worried about this kind of taking over? And like, he's like, well, no, because, you know, it's just like kids growing up, they take over. And, you know, so AI is growing up, it's going to take over. No big deal. I thought, wow. Okay. Right. So disconnect there. But I mean, like you said earlier in the show, I think that this is statistically, it's being proved out in what we're seeing with the increase, like dramatic exponential increases in self-harm, suicide statistics, you know, in young people, if they even make it into adulthood, you know, they're very damaged because they, I mean, it's like, if this is so great for us and so great for society, then why aren't we seeing it improve anything, really? You know, is it improving our health, our mental health, our relationships, the important things? Is it even increasing our wealth? It's increasing wealth for some people, but there's more disparity in income than there was. There's more increased poverty. It's not, we're not getting the results that we've been promised. And I think, and unfortunately, like, the same mistake is being made again, where we turn to the same thing that caused the problem to begin with to try to fix it, like more tech. Let's throw more tech at it to fix the problems that tech created. That's not going to work. And I don't know. I think we're all also programmed to believe it will eventually work. And we just have to push through this awkward, terrible time where everybody, all these kids are killing themselves because eventually it's going to be so great. And it isn't. I don't believe that. I think that that is really naive. And I think that is a totally false narrative. And it's pushed on us by people who don't have our best interests in mind, who only care about furthering their wealth and power positions and at our expense. So,
you know, let's take our next break, because I want to delve further into what you just said, because there's consequences for us giving up our sovereignty, isn't there? So let's take our next break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Shannon Rowan. And before the break, again, you've done just a really masterful job of laying out what I think the major gist of all of this technology is. It's to make us subservient, I think, to not let us even know that they were in a cage. And I wanted to delve into basically what happens if we do this. I mean, we're seeing, I remember when Doge was around, I don't know if it still is, but we're hooking everything in our society to this technology grid, right? Whether it's our taxes, whether it's our social media presence, now our banking, and maybe if they digitize the money, and it's going to be like a social credit scores like it is in China, it seems to me, then everything that we do is somehow, it's no longer private. And to me, once that happens, you really do have to watch your P's and Q's, basically, or they're going to tell you what you're thinking and then act accordingly. Is this encroachment something that do you see it happening? Am I being a little bit more of an alarmist about it, or is this not my imagination?
No, yeah, it's definitely. I mean, it's even been like, and there's these plans are like openly discussed and announced, and yet, you know, of course, there's the predictive programming of sci-fi so-called movies where it's like, well, you get warmed up to this dystopian future by getting familiar with it, and then like before you know it, it's like, oh, that movie that used to feel like a horror movie, it's like feels like normal everyday life now. Maybe it's not so bad. but we forget why it matters to have privacy. I think if you look at any kind of control state, like any like totalitarian state, it's all about taking away privacy. And I think, you know, and the people who live in those societies, I would say China definitely is one of those, you know, they're used to it. Maybe they don't like it, but they don't remember. A lot of them now just don't know any other way. And that's what's really dangerous. I call it the totalitarian tiptoe. And it's like step by step, you know, and it's like, so they could have, you know, people who want to have power, like they say, like power corrupts absolutely. It's almost like it's a disease and a kind of like lust that never gets fulfilled and it's never enough, right? So it's like the technology is definitely something, a tool for like sick people who want to, you know, have power and more power. That's so tempting for them to just, that's why it's like expanding, because it's expanding at a rate in a way that's unnecessary. You could look at just markets and say, well, it's because you can make more money off of this or this or that. But at some point it's beyond money, because these people with the trillions of dollars now, like money doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, it's like, it's about control and micromanaging every move we make. And so maybe you think, well, I don't have anything to hide, and so it doesn't matter. But it does, because, you know, first of all, things that you do can be misconstrued and used against you. And, you know, then you try to defend yourself. And there's this like, well, there's this digital, you know, like we call it paper trail, we used to say, but digital kind of trail of like what you've done and did and what you, where you've been, and can be completely manipulated to like say that you're this certain kind of person and you're dangerous. Basically, a dangerous person can be anybody who's threatening the person in power. So, you know, it's like suddenly it's a crime to just speak about what we're talking about because it's dangerous to somebody's position. And then we've seen this in other regimes where people are, political prisoners and they're killed and they're not just rights are taken away or their privacy taken away, you know, taken to the extreme. It's like being tortured, being imprisoned, being killed, just for being somebody who wants to think critically, who thinks we should have more sovereignty, who thinks we should have more freedom. So I think what we're in danger right now is forgetting why it matters to have liberties. Where this can go, where it has gone already, what we've already given up and said is okay. I mean, our constitutional rights are completely being steamrolled. I mean, with even just having smart meters on your home, which can be used as a surveillance device, I've heard of like at least one ruling where, you know, people came to the court, higher courts, and said, this is against our Fifth Amendment rights. And they said, well, actually, in this case, your rights don't matter because the greater good of the surveillance of for catching a criminal like trumps your right to your own privacy. And so that's setting a precedent already in courts now with these surveillance devices, which is what they are, besides being health robbing. Even if you're saying, well, it's robbing me of my health and I'm having all these health problems. No, surveillance is more important because it's more important that we catch a terrorist or, you know, pre-crime stuff. I mean, there's pre-crime technology in the works, has been for a long time. And that means thought reading technology. I mean, I think it was even like maybe 10 years ago or so, I've written about this in one of my books, at least, where, you know, they're talking about implementing thought reading technology that's remotely, like you could read your thoughts because of your brain waves and they can then translate that, or even like weird things like putting something on, there's something you put on your throat. And apparently we make like vibrations in our throat when we're thinking about things, like as if we're speaking, but we're not speaking, but we start to like want to speak, and it's just gets really crazy. But this has like been studied. I mean, studying our brains and thoughts and mind control, mind reading has been technology. That's been like, you know, I get back into the history of this with cybernetics and brain doctors from like the 40s and 50s. I mean, ever since there was radio frequencies, it was used to, you know, experiment with mind control and with reading thoughts and brain waves and studying our brains. So it really can get very creepy. And I mean, again, I think what's really scary to me is that people are forgetting why it matters if our thoughts are being read or not, you know? And I think that, like, it reminds me of when I was in high school in the, I graduated in 1990 from high school. And when I went into high school, we had a lot more freedom than just in those 4 years when I was getting out, like my last year. And I was complaining to my art teacher and said, well, I'm like, wow, this is just like feels so oppressive, like this, because we had a new regime of like our principal or something. And I'm like, why isn't anybody protesting this? And he said, because the younger generation, already just a few years younger than me, that came into this our school the way it was, they didn't know any different. He said, they don't know any different, so they're not going to protest. They don't know what it felt like to have, you know, not have to have a hall pass all the time, or, you know, get out, you can go on and off campus or whatever. I mean, now it's like people going through, kids going through metal detectors, and, you know, it's like something so different from what I experienced. And here's the other interesting thing about surveillance. Surveillance societies are not safer. Interestingly, crime rates seem to be higher. It's always like, well, we need more surveillance because there's more crime now. Well, why is there more crime? Because when people feel like they're in a cage, they get aggressive. You know, when you don't have your freedom and you don't have, I mean, why are you alive then if you're in a cage? You know, so people get angry, they become aggressive. This is all goes back to like what's best for people and mental and physical health. If we're healthy, then we're not going to be aggressive and we're not going to have crime and we don't need surveillance, right? So it's like we're missing out in the bigger picture of what matters. But I really am worried that people are just too happy to give up their privacy rights. I mean, when the first, cookies things came up, when the first internet pages were asking for consent for all these things, we used to read the consent forms and we would say no to them. And it used to be like, I'm not going to agree to that. And you had a choice because then the companies were forced to like step back and say, okay, go ahead and use the website, because we didn't need the internet. It was an option. So, but now when, like you're saying, if everything's tied into it, if you're banking and everything gets tied into this thing and you don't have the options anymore. And what I've been seeing is that we don't have the option to reject the cookies that are tracking us. we don't have the option to even reject biometrics data now. Well, no, now they want you to scan your face, you know, now. And it's like increased, it's always like, well, we just have to protect you. You know, it's under this guise of like protecting us, but it's oppressing us. At what point do we say it's too oppressive? It doesn't matter anymore about being protected. I mean, again, like being in a cage, you're more protected, but you're in a cage. What matters to you in your life? What do you want to do in your life? Do you want to be just glued to a screen, stuck in virtual reality, you know, with some like brain chip? And like, I don't know. I mean, I think it's time to step back and ask these really important questions and not just go along with everything, because every step of the way is going in that direction of more control. And that means like, I mean, it's restrictions on travel, it's restrictions on which we've been experiencing a lot in the last several, you know, years, getting used to this being, you know, restricted in that regard. But it's going to get worse, because I think the only jobs available are the ones that are kind of like to build your own prison. You know, like you have to work for the thing that's imprisoning you. And so that's getting frightening. And it's just, you know, I could go on and on about this. I don't want to get too depressing about it either. But
it's important to bring it out so that people can stop being distracted by these false arguments, something that pits us against each other. It seems to be the thing, what team you're on, what tribe you're in, something to make you feel like I'm the special group and you're the other and I need to come after you. But we're all in the same boat. And if we don't see it that way, then they're able to divide and conquer at will, which is seems to me what's going on as well. On that note, let's take our last break, because I really want to go over that, because it seems it's a cottage industry of the next outrageous thing that makes people up in arms. And as soon as your brain, you know, your heart kicks in, your brain stops working. So on that note, let's take our last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living in Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Rowan. And how can people buy your books and see other interviews that you've done?
Yeah, I have a website. It's wifirefugee.com, but it's wifi with a hyphen, refugee.com. So wifi-refugee.com. It will soon be also shannonrowan.com, but it's not quite linked up yet. But yeah, there's links there to where you can get my books, but basically Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Also from me directly if you're in the US. So, and I didn't really want to do eBooks, but I do have eBooks. I encourage people to read from print, because there's a difference in how we retain and information, actually process that if we're not reading on a screen. So yeah, do please buy the print books where you can. It doesn't save our trees to use electronic devices. In fact, all the data centers that have to keep coming up means forests going down, a lot more environmental devastation happening as we go more digital. So
yeah, I actually wanted to ask you that question about these data centers. They're also taking out farms as well, aren't they? So our food supply is being affected, our water is being affected, let alone what we're paying in electrical, you know, costs, you know, for our baseline or our bottom line.
Yeah, it's not sustainable. We keep hearing the word sustainable thrown around, but as we use, the more electronics we use, the more electricity you use, the more data centers you need, the more electricity you need, the more energy you need. It's not in the way you harvest it, the green, so-called green energy, that's a topic for another book. I do have a little bit about it in the Red Shoes, but it's not green either. That's sold to us as green, and it just isn't. Unfortunately, data centers use up a lot of water, and actually mostly just to cool them, because they have to stay cool. And they're using, most data centers in our country are in the Southwest in the desert, because it's cheaper land. But in the desert, there's less water. And it's hotter, but they're using water for evaporative cooling. And so that water, it's something like, forget how many gallons a day, but it is shocking how much water one data center in a day will use. It's like something like enough for like a city of like 500,000 or 100,000 people. And then it's, you know, and it goes right back into the, you know, it's polluted with all these chemicals, goes back into the groundwater after that, wastewater, you know, full of chemicals. So, I mean, people were looking, you know, when you're holding your little device and you're on a wireless grid, you don't see the effects that has. It's not the energy that's in, it's not the battery in your hand. It's the whole chain of supply and, you know, from the mines where there's human rights violations and children dying to make your cell phone, you know, to, for the components like cobalt and coltan and rare earth minerals that then go to China where there's more exploitation. And people working as slaves in the manufacturing side of it, you know, assembly. And then it's like, if it were to be manufactured in the US, an iPhone would cost something like $30,000 for an iPhone. So yeah, it's only because of slave labor in other countries that this, any of this is even possible. So when we start talking about, you know, like you're saying, the things that divide us, that are used to divide us, like in our country with like racial divisions, distractions, it's like we forget that we are all more privileged here than in some other countries where actually, and where there are people of color, you know, being exploited, like in the Congo, and Asians in Asia, and somehow they're forgotten about. And when we're all using the same technology that is exploiting those people. You know, and so we're also all being manipulated and all being lied to. And so it would really help if we came together and saw the common ground and that we're commonly all being abused in this way, and came together and helped free each other instead of, right, you said, like coming into these different camps and tribes and kind of over these different very emotive issues and not seeing how that's also, you know, manipulation.
I agree. And the mindset, or at least the talking point, that these data centers are going to provide jobs and it's going to be an explosion of our economy. Is that true? I mean, I've heard that not many people man these centers once they're built.
No. Yeah. I mean, and of course, as we get more into like using AI and robotics, it's less, it's always going to be fewer jobs for humans. And what's really worries me with AI taking over jobs is that creative jobs are being taken over. You know, it's one thing to kind of assign to machines to do like kind of, you know, menial labor jobs for us. And even then, you know, with the Industrial Revolution itself, and now we're supposedly in the fourth one, right? So all these industrial revolutions, every time we're promised that these machines will give us more leisure time and more wealth, and it doesn't happen. Why don't we have more leisure time? Why don't we have more time to go in nature with our families and have leisure time? It never happens. You know, what happened to the 3-day work week or all these promises? So I doubt it's going to somehow, it'll take over all of our jobs and we'll just be free to like not work. No, we won't have it. You could not work. You have no money. You'll have no home. You'll have no food. You'll die. You know, you'll have to be homeless or something. So no, I don't see that helping us with jobs. And it's always, again, the same lie. It's the same lies. We need to realize it's a pattern and this is just getting worse. And again, if you even did finally have leisure time to go out in nature, you'll find that nature is gone because there's a data center, you know? So, I mean, it's just the environmental destruction is just like, it's enormous. And I have not engaged with AI yet. I mean, not willingly, maybe unwittingly it's happened when I've been on the internet, but I don't ask it anything intentionally or anything, but because when you engage with that, that's just another level of like harm because of what is required in terms of data centers and, you know, and resources to power AI is just much worse than what we've already been dealing with. I mean, this is a quandary we're all in. I'm not perfect here. I'm on my computer right now. I'm on the internet. That's data, you know, that's what we're doing here. Some days I really fantasize about just getting off completely. And I wonder how, and it's interesting though, when I do that, because I realize just how dependent I've become, even as somebody who is not 24/7 tethered, like a lot of people, I've gotten sucked into this dependent on it as well, like banking and online commerce and, you know, communications. And then I think, well, what if I can't get online at all? What happens? Can I even exist? Can I provide food for myself, you know, my family? And this is the kind of thing that we have to start looking at, like what happens if it just goes down, because as it is a very vulnerable system, like you're, you know, talking about everything being tied to it, that means that all can just go down like that. And that would plunge the world into complete chaos, like instantly. When you have all these systems dependent on something that's so vulnerable.
Agreed. And that doesn't keep you safe either. I mean, how many hacks or attacks have we seen on various companies? Don't forget about the healthcare system where hospitals have been blackmailed. You know, they take the cyber attack, take your whole system down, and you have to pay. And all your data seems to be going. You always get a letter about, oh, you were compromised and we just want to let you know. But it's already happened. How do they pull that back? So for that mindset of it's perfect, it's impenetrable, it's a complete lie. It's a scam, isn't it?
Yes. And honestly, it is a lot. It's much more archival and easier to access like paper records. You know, of course, there can be fires now and then, but I'm actually starting to kind of like, I used to try to like scan everything. I'm like, oh, it'd be nice to have all these papers and a digital file. And then I find that I never open those files. Then my hard drive gets corrupted. It's gone like that in an instant. Like there was a fire, you know, it happens so easily. And as these, I mean, cause none of our hardware even is made to last. You know, there's this planned obsolescence and everything electronic. So, you know, it's vulnerable in that sense as well. So if you actually have papers you care about, like, you know, your letters from your grandma or journals from your family, I mean, it's like, keep them on the paper, in the paper form. right. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I'm worried about people kind of getting, more sucked into virtual reality, virtual living, where they've sort of lost the sense of even why it's important to be in the physical form and physical reality. I mean, as we kind of move into this digital living in a way, which I don't see as living, you know, we start disconnecting so much that we don't care enough about our environment around us. We're not present enough to even start to say, oh, my water's polluted, my food's polluted. Why does that matter? Why does it matter for the future generations? Why does it matter? Like this, even the minimalist movement, I feel like has links to this idea of like virtual reality, because I remember seeing a picture in this book called Goodbye Things. It was popular for a while, Japanese author. And there were some good points about, yeah, like not becoming a hoarder and like getting too tied to your things. But to take into the extreme, and his extreme example was a friend of his who lived in an apartment that was bare walls, bare everything. He had one futon roll. He had owned nothing because he spent most of his time sitting on that futon roll with a virtual reality headset on and gaming. And it was scariest image. And I thought, wow, this person is checked out. He's not here. He doesn't care what he's in a cell. It looks like he's in a padded cell. That's his apartment. You know, and it reminds me that Nicholas Carteris, who wrote, you know, Digital Madness and Glow Kids, he wrote in Digital Madness, the beginning, how he saw an image of a cow hooked up to VR at a conference he went to, because the cows are getting VR so that they can make better milk, because it can trick them into thinking they're in green pastures when they're imprisoned in a, you know, without lights or windows or air from, I mean, it's like, you start thinking Matrix movies and it's like, just gets really crazy. So.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking at that moment. I mean, from the standpoint of, you know, we only have I'd love to have you come back because we're just scratching the surface. But in the couple moments or minutes we have left, what's one thing that people can do to disengage from the system and not empower it further?
Yeah, well, definitely just taking more time off. I mean, one thing that's true of any kind of addiction too, you won't know how bad it is until you get away from it. You need to prove to yourself you're not addicted. Take some time off. But, you know, I mean, really, but see what you feel like. And you need more than like a couple hours. I'd say I try to challenge people to take at least one day off per week, at least 1 hour per day. If you can't do 1 hour per day, there's a real problem there. And I mean, like, no screens, right? Just away from your screens. But take one full day a week. Two, if you can, take the whole weekend. Don't get on your screens. Don't get on your tech and see what happens. It's amazing what happens. There's this withdrawal period where you're still kind of amped up and it's hard to calm down. And then once you calm down and relax, you'll see what a full day can feel like and how long it can feel. And you can go, do all these things that you forgot about that are amazing, actual things that are physically based, you know, nature based. I love gardening. I love when I have a full day just in the garden. I feel so good after. It's just incredible. It's so simple, but it's so profoundly effective. And then you might say, maybe this is worth fighting for. Maybe we've forgotten this. It's easy to forget. You know, we've been hypnotized. We've been seduced. We're lost in Oz. We don't really know where we are anymore. And if you can just come home, Dorothy, click your red shoes, come home and like, just remember what that's like. And it'll open up your eyes and you might start to reevaluate. And I think that's what, you know, we can all hope for. But other things like, you know, are great. Like any kind of physically based like movement activity or sitting activity like meditation, in committing to that, like here's what something I'll leave with you, with the listeners. I committed myself on August 1st of last summer to a one walk a day challenge every day. And I have not missed a day. And to me, the walk is like, it's a walk just to have a walk and I'm not doing something else during the walk. Like there's no other purpose. Right. And I'm fortunate that there's trails outside my house. It's easier for me, but I don't care where you are. If you can't take a walk for at least like 15, 20 minutes a day, that's another problem, you know? And it's like, so give yourself that time. You're not on a screen. You don't have any other obligations. And what it does for me is it calms down my mind. It's kind of like meditating, but also like helps me kind of, you know, just remember things I needed to do sometimes, or just to have that space to, and especially emotionally, and we're all needing this. We're all very anxious because again, our technology addiction is making us very anxious. But it can really reduce that. You might find that you can go off your medications even if you keep that up, you know, that, oh, I just needed some time to be rooted in nature just to have a walk. And I didn't get that. And that made me crazy. but I like the challenge of, I have a book. I keep it like a physical book. I write every day where I went, kind of like a captain's log. And that helps keep me committed to it. And it's kind of like, there's these things kids do with technology, like with Snapchats, with the streaks they want to maintain and they can't break their streak, but it keeps them on their devices. We'll replace that challenge with something like this. Doesn't have to be a walk. It could be something else, but challenge yourself and commit, you know, and hold yourself to it somehow. Hopefully not by having to use technology, use old school stuff with a book or a friend that you're doing it with, check in with each other. The more people involved, the better, or like sign up for a class of some kind, that yoga, whatever that interests you. But those small changes really make a big difference, because I think what's really needed now is our care. Our earth, our world needs our care, needs our attention. Our relationships need our care and attention. Everything does. We're important. We need to be here and be present. So I think it's just remembering who we are and that we are that important. And this is like, you know, also a spiritual journey. Once you get rooted back into the physical world, I think that is a kind of gateway into the spiritual realm too. For me, that's my perspective on it, but you'll find your own. But just at least starting with that awareness and getting off the devices, spending less time on them, you know, reducing their grab and your grasp on your life and their importance in your life. And then you'll start to like, hopefully we'll find creative ways to get out of this, because if we let it happen, you know, if we let it keep going the way it is, then you don't have any options anymore. And it's like already it's starting to become non-optional to, like, I'm starting to get locked out of some things online because I don't have a cell phone to get the SMS messages. And then they want me to like scan QR codes to, you know, scan my face and stuff. I don't have that ability. And I'm like, oh, I guess I can't use that anymore. and that's just happening very quickly. And it's like, suddenly it's like, you can't even use the internet unless you just, you know, again, unless we agree to their terms. And are we going to keep agreeing to the terms, or are we going to say no? Where's the line for you? You know, you have to decide, we have to decide now how far we're willing to go with this, because before you know it, you have a chip in your brain. And that's serious, like real reality.
Yeah, there's no comeback from that.
Yeah.
You just described how much power we have over the system. We're ceding it and we're volunteering it. Withdraw your consent and they'll have to stop. They can't do it without us. And then we get our lives back. I just want to thank you so much for joining me today. It was an excellent conversation. I learned a lot. I know my listeners did too. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. George. I hope we can do it again. I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, I look forward to it. I want to thank you for your time, and I want to thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.